Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, January 11th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Front page has a large color picture of what looks like an empty classroom, and the headline says, Winter Weather Prompts Virtual Learning for Learning Day for Dubuque Schools. This is reported by Elizabeth Kelsey. Elisa Burke sat in her classroom at Irving Elementary School on Wednesday, hard at work despite the empty chairs and desks around her. While her first grade students were at home for the day due to adverse weather, winter weather, they still were completing a day of schoolwork, and Burke was still providing educational support from afar. When I came into school, I reached out to parents using our parent communication app or sent an email, and I'm here all day if they need any support, Burke said. It's going well so far. On Wednesday, the Dubuque District staff and students had their first virtual learning day as a result of inclement weather. The district implemented the new policy this year, the school year, after Iowa law was changed to allow schools to deliver up to 5 days of instruction virtually each year. On virtual learning days, all Dubuque District staff, including teachers, paraprofessionals, food service workers, transportation workers, and other staff support, are required to report to work. School offices open and staff are asked to arrive 2 hours later than the normal start time. Superintendent Amy Hawkins said one reason all staff must physically report to campuses on virtual learning days is to ensure the district's hourly staff do not lose a day of pay, since the day would not be made up at the end of the school year. So, rather than serving lunches or driving buses on Wednesday, the district's hourly employees were participating in training and professional development sessions. Teachers also had time to work on professional development throughout the day in addition to providing educational support for students. Really, it's about trying to get everybody in the district engaged so that they don't lose that day of pay, Hawkins said. The district does have a plan for critical weather cancellations when conditions make it impossible for anyone to travel to district buildings. Such was the case Tuesday when Dubuque received over 12 inches of snow in a 2-day winter storm that prompted district officials to cancel classes entirely. Hawkins said the weather forecast Monday indicated that neither students on school buses nor staff in vehicles would be safe coming to schools Tuesday, so the district decided to cancel. By Tuesday evening, district officials had driven various Dubuque roads and judged that they were clear enough to allow staff to drive to work safely the next day. Though the county roads and gravel lanes on which the district buses must travel still were not safe. Days like this are really why we created virtual learning, she said. This would have been a day where we would have had to cancel due to the county roads, because we can't get buses out there, but this way we could still have school. Employees unable to make it into work Wednesday could draw from their available leave balance, district officials said. Burke, who lives in the city of Dubuque and enjoys driving in the snow, said she didn't mind having to come to Irving on Tuesday. Collaborating with my team members is the reason why I want to be here in person, because today we have uninterrupted time to work with our colleagues and plan things out, she said. Is today's work something that I could do virtually? Potentially, but I enjoy being at school. I don't speak for everyone, but for me, I like to be here in the building. She also is glad staff and students will not have to make up as many days at the end of the school year when air outside in the building, Irving building, get hot. District staff with school-age children can bring the students to school with them on virtual learning days. Burke, for example, was accompanied by her 5-year-old daughter, Grace, who attends kindergarten at Irving. Irving Principal Susan Meehan said the school had about 15 staff members' children present Wednesday. Most were completing their assignments for the day in the school's technology lab under the supervision of paraprofessionals. On virtual learning days, middle and high school students complete assignments on the district's online Canvas platform, as they all are issued a computer or similar device and can take it home each night. Hawkins said secondary teachers could either set up one-on-one virtual meetings with students or hold drop-in virtual office hours during the day. Meanwhile, elementary students, who do not have technological devices assigned to them, complete work from a printed differentiated learning packet sent home with them in the fall. Each packet includes 5 days' worth of activities in art, music, wellness, language arts, math, science, social studies, and the district's second step, social-emotional learning curriculum. Burke said students are not required to complete the packets, but she will provide feedback for any student who turns it in. For families who may not have access to the packets that were sent home, the day's activities for each grade are posted on the district's website. Parents also can pick up packets at the district school, any district school, and Hawkins said some staff were delivering packets to families who needed them on Wednesday. We're trying to make it as easy as we can for folks, while also ensuring that students are getting some kind of an educational support and learning done today, Hawkins said. The article is also accompanied by a picture of School Superintendent Amy Hawkins. And on the right side of the front page, we have a story by John Cruz. It's the headline, Avello to pause Dubuque flights until November. An airline flying out of Dubuque Regional Airport plans to pause its service to Orlando, Florida, as it moves to offering seasonal flights. Dubuque Regional Airport officials announced Wednesday that flights between Dubuque and Orlando will pause in early April and resume in November. Flights will be paused, Airport Director Todd Dalsing said. They will pick up in November. Avello's website currently offers bookings between Dubuque and Orlando up to April 6. Scheduled flights through early April will not be impacted, an airport press release states. Dalsing said Avello officials made the decision as part of a company-wide move to transition service at 8 airports throughout the country to a seasonal air service schedule. The decision was driven by a combination of overall air service demand, the availability of aircraft and crew and aircraft maintenance schedules, he said. This is how ultra-low-cost carriers operate, he said. They review their network quarterly and make changes depending on demand and need. The release states that Avello has modified service at 26 airports in the past year, and at least 2 other low-cost carriers have done so in more than 20 markets in the same time frame. Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Molly Grover stressed that Dubuque is not unique in experiencing cuts to air service. The airlines are continually and in real time adjusting their network, she said. It is the world we live in. The news comes as the Dubuque Community Air Service Task Force continues to seek an air carrier that will return daily service to Dubuque Regional Airport after American Airlines stopped service to Dubuque in September 2022. The task force and Dubuque Chamber plan to host a forum discussing those efforts February 22nd. Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said in the release that the return of daily air service to Dubuque remains a top priority. We will not rest until we achieve this goal, he said. Though we wish there was less disruption in the airline industry right now, we do appreciate the service Avello has provided to our community, and we appreciate their continuing partnership. Officials with Avello Airlines did not return calls Wednesday seeking further details on their planned service changes at the Dubuque Airport. Avello began offering flights between Dubuque and Orlando in March. To guarantee the airline would bring service to the community, the City of Dubuque and Dubuque County contributed $500,000 each to a minimum revenue guarantee agreement from which Avello could pull to offset its initial investment in the community. The airline had withdrawn all of those funds by September. That same month, Avello began offering air service between Dubuque and Las Vegas, but 2 months later, the airline announced it would end that route January 6. Speaking with the Telegraph Herald, Kavanaugh said the latest reduction in air service by Avello is disappointing, but he stressed that the community has benefited from the minimum revenue guarantee agreement. On top of bringing service to Orlando, Kavanaugh pointed to the airport's most recent annual allotment of federal funding from the Airport Improvement Program, which totaled $1 million because the airport had recorded more than 10,000 annual passenger boardings. Airports with fewer than 10,000 annual enplanements are only provided up to $150,000 per year through the program. However, Dahlstein said Dubuque Regional Airport has never had a year where boardings fell below the level to be eligible for the higher allotment from the Airport Improvement Program. Kavanaugh stressed that the city will continue to pursue minimum revenue guarantee agreements with airlines to attract new service. Last year, the city was awarded a $1.5 million federal grant with a $535,000 local match from the Small Community Air Service Development Program to attract new air service to Dubuque. That money could be used to provide future minimum revenue guarantees to airlines looking to bring additional air service to the community. None of this is a simple equation for us, Kavanaugh said. If we want air service back, we can't turn away from a minimum revenue guarantee in some form. The article is accompanied by pictures of those mentioned in the article, Todd Dalsing, Molly Grover, and Brad Kavanaugh. At the bottom of the front page, we have a picture headlined, "Welcome to Winter," and the caption says, "People begin to clear snow along Shiras Avenue in Dubuque on Wednesday after a winter storm that left a heavy blanket of the white stuff. Dubuque officially received 12.6 inches during the two-day storm, with 11.5 inches falling on Tuesday." The picture was taken by staff photographer Dave Kettering. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, page 2, we have a story headlined, "Attempted Murder Trial for Man Accused in 2021 Assault Begins." An attempted murder trial against a man accused of severely injuring a Dubuque woman in a 2021 assault has begun. Frederick T. Woods, Jr., 30, of Peoria, Arizona, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with attempted murder, willful injury causing serious injury, domestic assault impeding airflow, operating a vehicle without the owner's consent, child endangerment, first-degree harassment, and domestic assault, third or subsequent offense. His trial began Wednesday with jury selection, opening statements, and the start of testimony. Iowa District Court Judge Monica Zrini-Ackley is overseeing the proceedings. In opening statements, Assistant Dubuque County Attorney Jonathan Dunn told jurors he planned to prove that Woods, then of Dubuque, assaulted Brianna M. Hansen, then 30, of Dubuque, in June 2021 at a Dubuque residence. The assault included several instances of strangulation, Dunn said, as well as myriad other physical assaults that left Hansen with severe injuries necessitating hospitalization. "He assaulted her, he strangled her, and he pushed her onto a bed," Dunn said. "And as they were doing this, he told her, 'I am going to kill you,'" defense attorney Joey told her. Joey Hoover contested Dunn's retelling of the 2021 events in the defense's opening statement, pointing to Hansen's initial identification of a different assailant. Hansen, who was in a relationship with Woods at the time of the assault, initially identified a different individual to police court documents state, before identifying Woods as her attacker in May of 2023. "This case is about who did it," Hoover said. "What you're going to hear is that the investigation narrowed quickly, and because it seemed easiest, it narrowed on Mr. Woods, who was in a relationship with Ms. Hansen." Dunn acknowledged the discrepancy, but told jurors to consider the role of fear and relationship dynamics in Hansen's initial report. The moral of the story is fear, he said. Unfortunately, there are situations where there is isolation and fear as a result of alleging that a loved one has harmed you. Hansen was called as the prosecution's first trial witness. She spoke of the continued impact the assault has had on her life, but she told Dunn her exact memories of the event and her attacker remain unclear. I have stress-induced seizures now, she said. My body underwent a lot of trauma, and that's how it deals with it. And I underwent enough damage to my right leg that I had to do 6 months of intensive physical therapy to walk again. Hansen's testimony is expected to continue this morning. Testimony from Dubuque Police Department officers, medical professionals, and other expert witnesses will follow. The article is accompanied by a picture of the defendant, Frederick T. Woods, Jr. On the Tri-State page, we have a story by Mike Putz of the Manchester Press, and it's headlined, Manchester City Council Questions Citizen Costs Associated with Proposed Street Work. This is from Manchester, Iowa, of course, and it writes, while the Manchester City Council approved sending work on the 2024 East Main Street project out for bids, the council voted to table a resolution that would have assessed properties affected by the project. The council voted 4-0 to table the resolution and will revisit the issue in 2 weeks. Council member Brian Gray abstained from voting as he is one of the property owners along the proposed project. The proposed project consists of the reconstruction of existing streets, the installation of new sanitary sewer, storm sewer, water main, sidewalks, and reconstruction of driveways on and along East Main Street from a point approximately 50 feet west of its intersection with Bailey Drive on the west to a point approximately 60 feet west of the intersection with Stiles Street on the east. The estimated total assessment split between the 21 property owners affected could be as high as $245,000. During a public hearing, council member Linda Schmidt said she believed the assessment and subsequent cost for new sidewalks, driveways, water, sewer, curb, and gutter would create a hardship for many of the property owners. I do not believe the assessments are fair. The citizens shouldn't have to pay. It should be part of the street. I know some people, if they have to pay for this, will probably put their house up for sale. I think the resolution should be changed and that the city should pay for the curb and gutter. Mayor Connie Brinken responded to Schmidt, asking, how is that fair for the people who have been doing it for all these years? Former council member Dean Sherman said the assessment program was developed in the late 80s or early 90s to generate funds for projects. It was a challenge to find money at the time, Sherman explained, between local option sales tax, LOST, and coming up with this assessment plan. I'm proud this has continued. Hundreds of people have paid thousands of dollars and have contributed to projects. That's why we have quality streets throughout the whole community. Sherman told the council it might be a good time for them to evaluate the street improvements plan when it comes to assessments and the impact on low-income households. I think it's a good idea to take a look at it, but not in the middle of a project. Another thing that may have impact this, is what is the state going to do about funding in this next legislative session? It might be a good time to look at this in your budget session and see how you can find the money. Street Superintendent Jason Haight and Wastewater Superintendent Perry Peterson told the council sewer work is also needed along the proposed project. Part of the sewer out there has collapsed, Peterson said. We have been doing what we can to get by, hoping it would be replaced in this project. If it doesn't happen with this project, it will happen next summer. Gray said he was elected to curb city spending. The $1.6 million on top of our debt would put us up to almost $13 million. I am sitting in this seat because I was elected by the people to curb spending. I understand about making the city great, but that is not what the people are looking at. Times are tough. This is expensive for me, and I can afford it. The article is again reported by Mike Putz, and that's about the Manchester, Iowa City Improvements discussion. Now we turn to the opinion page for a column by Ed Zaccaro, and his column is titled Math Matters, What If Light and Sound Had a Race? Ed Zaccaro is the author of graduated from Oberlin College, has a master's degree in gifted education from the University of Northern Iowa. He is the author of several math books, including one on the misuse of statistics. His work is currently being used around the world and has been translated into several languages. Ed Zaccaro's column, then, is again, Math Matters, What If Light and Sound Had a Race? Math is often taught as all scales and no music. Students must have the opportunity to see the exciting and interesting parts of mathematics. It is common knowledge that light and sound are both extremely fast. But what if they were to take part in an actual competition? What if they were to have a race, a sprint across a football field? Our race between light and sound will start at the goal line of Soldier Field in Chicago. The finish line is 100 yards away at the other goal line. Light, of course, will win the race because it moves at a faster speed than sound. But how far will sound have traveled when light traverses the entire 100 yards, crosses the finish line, and is declared the winner? A. Sound will be at about the 50-yard line. B. Sound will be at about the 10-yard line. C. Sound will have traveled approximately 2 feet. And D. Sound will have traveled 1/250th of an inch. The answer is at the end of the column. Before we get to the answer, let's compare the speed of light and sound. Light is so fast that it can circle the earth over 7 times in 1 second. The speed of sound is also extraordinarily fast. It is so fast that until 1947, no airplane was able to fly faster than the speed of sound. But even though sound is extremely fast, light is literally almost 1 million times faster than sound. Light travels at a speed of approximately 186,000 miles each second, and sound travels only 1/5 of a mile in 1 second. Yes, light can move at an almost unbelievable speed, but even light is humbled by the distances it must travel in space. The light from our sun takes a little over 8 minutes to reach Earth. Light from Alpha Centauri, the closest star system to Earth, takes over 4 years to reach us. Thus, this means that if Alpha Centauri happened to explode, we wouldn't know about it until sometime during the year 2028, because the light from that explosion would take more than 4 years to reach our eyes. NASA's Hubble telescope recently captured a stunning view of a galaxy that is 100 million light years away. When we look at that galaxy, we are seeing it as it appeared 100 million years ago. The galaxy is so far away that the light it puts out takes 100 million years to reach our eyes, which means we are seeing the galaxy as it appeared while dinosaurs roamed the Earth. Note, always remember that a light year is a measurement of distance and not time. A light year is the distance light travels in 1 year. We can even use the speed of light and sound to determine how far away a thunderstorm is. Thunder and lightning occur at the same time. But because sound lags behind lightning, we almost always hear thunder a few seconds after we see the lightning. We can see that time lag we can use that time lag to tell us how far away we are from a storm. The next time you see lightning, start counting. If you hear thunder 5 seconds later, the storm is 1 mile away. 10 seconds later, and the storm is 2 miles away. Sound from thunder only travels 1/5 of a mile each second. If the lightning and thunder occur simultaneously, be careful. The storm is right over you. And now the answer. I hope you didn't pay too much for tickets to this less than exciting race. It only lasted 3 10-millionths of a second. The answer is D. Sound will have traveled 1/250th of an inch, or about the thickness of a human hair. That was the column presented by Ed Zaccaro, who has written a book that is used around the world on math and statistics. We have another view column. It's written by a frequent columnist, Arthur Sear, who is author of After the Cold War. His column this time, Provocations from North Korea, highlight South Korea's success. North Korea has decided to bring in the new year with a bang. Pyongyang regime, over several years, has fired sizable artillery barrages near a maritime buffer zone between North and South Korea. 2 years ago, in January 2022, the regime carried out 4 ballistic missile tests. Pyongyang described them as essential for self-defense. Other tests have followed, marking the end of hopes during the Trump administration that traditional tensions might be eased. North Korea has possessed at least rudimentary nuclear weapons since 2006. From time to time, Pyongyang threatens to use them against South Korea, Japan, and even the United States, though the distance involved makes that last target still relatively secure. In September 2021, Pyongyang announced successful launch of a cruise missile, an insidious weapon, flying low and difficult to detect with radar. An early version, the V-1 rocket of Nazi Germany, killed many people, overwhelmingly civilians, in Britain during World War II. President Donald Trump gave priority to trying to improve relations with long-isolated North Korea. There were several meetings with North Korea leader Kim Jong-un, facilitated by then-President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, but they failed. Meanwhile, South Korea continues on a positive course of exceptional economic growth and development, combined with now firmly established representative democracy. As recently as the early 1960s, South Korea was one of the poorest economies in the world. Still a peasant society, the entire Korean Peninsula was devastated by the Korean War of 1950-1953. Yet today, the Republic of Korea ranks among the strongest economies in the world, holding leadership roles in the automobile, advanced electronics, shipbuilding, and other industries. Rapid industrialization and economic modernization have been complemented by striking transition from dictatorship to democracy. President and General Park Chung-hee stifled incipient democracy and imposed extremely harsh military authoritarianism for nearly 2 decades. Park was assassinated in 1979 by the head of the KCIA, the National Intelligence Agency. In Korean memory, he remains a respected symbol of strength and effectiveness for many, though with progress and the passage of time that fades. General Park was succeeded as chief executive by 2 more generals, Chung Doo-hwan and Roh Tae-woo, but growing pressure for true democratic representation proved insurmountable. The capstone of transition to democracy was the election of Kim Dae-jung as president in 1998. He completed his 5-year term without interruption, and in 2000 received the Nobel Peace Prize. A public symbol of opposition to part dictatorship, he was imprisoned for several years. On another occasion, KCIA agents kidnapped him and planned to kill him. Only the intervention of senior U.S. CIA official Don Gregg saved his life. South Korea's remarkable domestic accomplishments have unfolded while the country becomes increasingly influential in global arenas. In 2012, the Obama administration shrewdly nominated President Jim Yong Kim of Dartmouth College, who was born in Seoul, as president of the World Bank. The original vision of the United Nations combined competing goals of favoring the most powerful nations and inclusive global representation. Kim and former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon personify South Korea's significant expanding role as a bridge between developed and developing nations. Market economies and reasonably representative governments now characterize a steadily increasing share of the world's developing nations. In short, South Korea is positioned to lead developing nations toward prosperity. Scare stories about actions of the North overshadow the good news regarding the South. This is most unfortunate. That is the Other View column, presented by frequent columnist Arthur I. Sear, who is the author of After the Cold War. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, January 11th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we have our shorter funeral services listings in alphabetical order. Sally A. Behncke, B-E-H-N-C-K-E, Sally A. Behncke, of Merrill, Wisconsin, graveside service, 10 a.m. Saturday, January 13, Prairie Cemetery, Fenimore. Stephen K. Kane, C-A-I-N, Stephen K. Kane, Muscatine, Iowa, visitation 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, January 13, Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Service 1 p.m. Saturday at the funeral home. John W. Dias, D-Y-A-S, John W. Dias, Andrew, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue. Service 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20. St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church, Springbrook. William J. Harry, Dubuque. Visitation 1 to 3:15 p.m. today, Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory on Asbury Road. Service 11:30 p.m. today at the funeral home. Charles E. Hawkins, Cascade, Iowa. Visitation 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, January 12, and at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 13. The Rife Funeral Home, Cascade. Service 1:30 p.m. Saturday, Cascade Community Presbyterian Church. J. B. Jellison, Dubuque. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today, with a prayer service 6:30 p.m. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 12, Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Janet E. Kramer, that's spelled K-R-A-M-E-R, Janet E. Kramer, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Memorial Gathering, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. today, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Prairie du Chien. Service, 1 p.m. today at the funeral home. Teresa J. Martin, Monona, Iowa, Celebration of Life, 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, January 13, Leonard Grau Funeral Home, Monona, service 3 p.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Shirley M. Mosier, Guttenberg, Iowa, visitation 9 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, January 13, St. John's Lutheran Church, Guttenberg, service 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Thomas S. Paulus, Platteville, Wisconsin, Visitation, 5 to 8 p.m., Saturday, January 12th, Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. Tommy R. Scott, Belmont, Wisconsin. Visitation, 10 to 11 a.m. today, Scales Mound United Methodist Church. Service, 11 a.m. today at the church. Charles R. Sickles, Montfort, Wisconsin. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. today, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, January 12th, Solman Larson Funeral Home, Montfort. Service, 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Clara String, S-T-R-E-N-G, Clara String, Dubuque. Service, 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 12th, Clare House Chapel, Mount St. Francis Center. And finally, Rose M. Wolfe, Cascade, Iowa. Visitation, 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 13, St. Martin Catholic Church, Cascade. Rosary service, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church, with service 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. And that concludes the list of the short funeral announcements. And now among our obituary notices, Shirley A. Noel, Shirley N. Rinneker Noel, 86, of Dubuque, passed away Tuesday, January 9th, at Stonehill Care Center. Visitation Friday, January 12th, 9:45 to 10:45 a.m. at Holy Spirit Parish, Holy Trinity Church, followed by Mass of Christian Burial at 11 a.m. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral mass can be viewed at the Egelhoff Seeger Casper Funeral Home website. Memorial donations may be made in Shirley's honor to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital or Holy Trinity Catholic Church. And that was for Shirley A. Rinneker, Shirley Ann Rinneker, Noel, 86, of Dubuque. We have Ruth Ann Botge-Nemers. I'm going to spell that middle name, B-O-T-T-G-E, Ruth Ann Botge-Nemers, 84, of Dubuque, passed away peacefully on January 6th. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 12th, at Egelhoff, Seegert, and Casper Funeral Home on Kennedy Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 13th, St. Patrick Catholic Church. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Live stream of the funeral mass can be viewed at the Egelhoff, Seegert, Casper Funeral Home website. And that was for Ruth Ann Botge-Nemers of Dubuque. Jerome H. Feldman, 91, of Dyersville, passed away Tuesday, January 9th, at Mercy One Senior Care in Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation, 2 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, January 14, at Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Visitation will continue on Monday morning at the funeral home from 9 to 10 a.m. prior to the funeral mass. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, January 15th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Chris Podaski will officiate, and the memorials may be made on behalf of Jerome H. Feldman to Dubuque County, Right to Life. The Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and you may direct memorials in care of the Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Lois George, 93, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, January 9th. Visitation, 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, January 14, at Egelhoff, Seegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. A mass of Christian burial will take place at 10:30 a.m. Monday, January 15th, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Linda Martins, 76, of Cambridge, Illinois, and formerly of Bellevue, Iowa, died on Saturday, December 30. Visitation, 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Wednesday, January 17, at Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Bellevue, where services will follow. Joyce Coleman, 81, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, January 10. Visitation, 1 to 4 p.m. Monday, January 15, at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. The burial will take place at a later date in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Richard J. Hocking, 65, of Galena, Illinois, died on Tuesday, January 9. Arrangements are pending. The Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family of Richard J. Hocking. And that concludes the funeral announcements and obituaries mentioned in today's issue. And now we look at the sports page for the Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week. It's Carter Widmeyer of East Dubuque. This is reported by Shannon Mum. East Dubuque's Carter Widmeyer knew coming into his senior year that he was going to be needed to produce more points. So, following the conclusion of his junior season, Widmeyer went to work in the gym last summer. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week put up more than 10,000 shots with the shooting machine, along with daily workouts and AAU games and practices. The senior leads East Dubuque with 11.7 points, 4.7 rebounds, and 3.4 assists per game. Carter really wanted to work on having confidence in his shot, and he put in the work this offseason, East Dubuque coach Scott Schaber said. He got in a lot of reps, and he's seeing that he is now confident shooting the ball with a hand in his face. Last Tuesday, Widmeyer led the team over West Carroll with 15 points and 3 assists. On Thursday against River Ridge, he scored a career-high 24 points on 9-for-13 shooting, including 6-for-7 from three-point range. He had 5 threes in the first quarter, Schaber said. That was a shooting performance I have not seen in a while. It's just a credit to the work he has put in. Widmeyer was elected as a team captain by his teammates. I knew this year I was going to have to make a big jump into a leadership role, Carter said. This is my senior year, and I wanted to take my game to the highest level attainable for me. I really became a gym rat over the off season, and I hope my younger teammates see how the extra work does pay off. Widmeyer credits one of his coaches, John Sweeney, along with friends Will Tucker and Thomas Herreau, for their support during the off-season workouts. Those guys were right there with me, pushing me when I would be in a slump, and always helping me out, he said. I'm really appreciative of all that they've done for me. Defensively, Widmeyer usually takes on the opponent's top offensive threat. It's very difficult to have the offense run through you and also defend the other team's top player, but he asks to do it, Schaber said. Widmeyer averages nearly 2 steals per game. I just love the game of basketball, he said. I've been playing since the second or third grade, and I love how difficult of a sport it is. There is no such thing as perfection in basketball. You can always improve on something. There's always work to be done. I also love all the friendships that I've made through playing basketball. He plans on continuing his basketball career next fall at the collegiate level. I think that with his hard work, Carter will continue to get better shooting from the outside, and if he does that, there's no ceiling on what he can do, Schaber said. And there is an action picture of East Dubuque's Carter Widmeyer driving through to the fence of Milledgeville during a recent game in Lanark, Illinois. He leads the Warriors with scoring with 11.7 points per game. Again, that was reported by, the picture is taken by Dave Kettering, and the article is reported by Shannon Mum. And we have a More Than the Score column by Jim Leitner, and the first item of several is Oberbreckling headed to IHSBCA Hall of Fame. And a veteran umpire with deep roots in Dubuque County will be among the five inductees into the Iowa High School Basketball Coaches Association Hall of Fame next weekend. Chris Oberbreckling, a Dyersville Beckman grad, has spent 34 seasons as an umpire while working at the high school, junior college, college, semi-pro, and minor league levels. He will be joined in the Hall of Fame class with coaches Dave Dirks, Mark Hay, and Jim Wesselman, and player John Knapp. Oberbreckling played Little League and Babe Ruth in the Dyersville Youth Program before earning three letters at Beckman. Following his playing days, Oberbreckling stayed involved in the game as an umpire and has worked more than 2,500 games. In 1990, he began umpiring high school, semi-pro, and college games. Oberbreckling attended the Brinkman Froming Umpire School in Cocoa Beach, Florida, in 1994, and graduated number 13 in a class of 150. Oberbreckling has worked 22 Iowa High School state tournaments, including 13 championship games. He has earned Northeast Iowa District Umpire of the Year 7 times and State Umpire of the Year 3 times. In 2016, Oberbreckling was named National Federation Officials Association State of Iowa Umpire of the Year. Oberbreckling also runs umpire clinics each year in the Cedar Rapids area and is a frequent speaker and presenter at umpire clinics around the state of Iowa. Last summer, he was inducted into the Dubuque County Baseball Hall of Fame. The inductees will be honored January 20 during the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association's annual banquet in Cedar Rapids. Another story, Dubuque Area Crowns Youth Bowling Champs. The Dubuque Area Youth Bowling Tournament featured competition at several houses during the holiday break. The Bantam Prep champions included Nolan Connor and Josh Glenn of Cherry Lanes, with a doubles count of 1,288, and the Chosen Ones for Cobra Cats of Cobra Lanes, Cheyenne Merkus, Miranda Kramer, and Jude Demmer, and Maverick Simon, with a team score of 2,561. In junior-senior, the winners were John Wickman and Hayden Tucker of Manchester's Lightning Lanes, with a score of 1,474 in doubles, and the Cobra Pro Shop squad of Karsten Rowan, Henry Dardis, Claire Hyland, and Drew Hyland with 2,544. The top scratch series were Josh Glenn with a 451 and Leah Hancock with a 367 in the Bantam Prep Division, while Gavin Wardle with a 714 and Allison Hedrick with a 559 led the junior-senior division. The top handicap series scores were Jonathan Bush with a 677 and Miranda Kramer with a 680 in Bantam Prep, and John Wickman with 781 and Ava Kennedy with 691 in junior-senior. And the third story is Dubuque native Roth coaching with USA Hockey at Worlds. Dubuque native and Harvard Women's Hockey Associate head coach Meredith Roth is serving as an assistant coach for the U.S. Under-18 Women's National Team at the 2024 International Ice Hockey Federation Under-18 Women's World Championship in Zug, Switzerland. Roth previously served as an assistant on the 2020 staff at the U18 World Championships and also worked the 2019 Under-18 Series versus Canada in Lake Placid, New York. Team USA has medaled in every IIHF Under-18 Women's World Championship competed, and making the gold medal game 14 of the last 15 years. Team USA has won gold 8 times, 2020, 2018, 2017, 2016, 2015, 2011, 2009, 2008, and the silver 6 times, 2022, 2019, 2014, 2013, 2012, and 2010, and the bronze once in last year, 2023. There is a picture accompanying that is related to the first story, and I'll read the caption. It says, Dyersville, Iowa native and umpire Chris Oberbreckling waits to make a call in an Iowa Class 3A sub-state game between Dubuque, Wallert, and DeWitt Central. Oberbreckling will be inducted into the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame next weekend in Cedar Rapids. And we go back to the opinion page to pick up the letter to the editor submitted by Therese Myers, M-A-I-E-R-S, Therese Myers, of Maple Road in Holy Cross, Iowa. And it's titled, Biden Making National Problems Worse. The news reported that President Biden approved another emergency aid distribution for Israel. I thought Congress had the power of the purse, and only it could approve spending allocations. The president is moving forward with forgiving student loan debt through a workaround of the law. Remember, the Supreme Court ruled that the president could not forgive student debt, only Congress. We have over 10,000 immigrants a day walking across our southern border. There are laws on the books regarding immigration, but the Biden administration refuses to enforce them. When the state of Texas placed barriers in the Rio Grande, the federal government sued to have them removed. Governor Abbott passed a state law to arrest trespassing along the border. The Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit. The Biden administration does not believe in protecting us from this invasion of drugs, human trafficking, and foreign adversaries. And the sovereignty of our nation is as provided and the sovereignty our nation of our nation as provided in the Constitution. But yet Democrats say Donald Trump is a, quote, threat to democracy, unquote, and he will be a dictator. But what would you call what we are living under now? Thank God President Biden is on vacation much of the time. With the withdrawal debacle in Afghanistan, the Chinese spy balloon crossing the country, 2 ongoing wars in Ukraine and Israel, over 150 attacks in the Middle East funded by Iran, and China telling Biden it will be annexing Taiwan. Think what a bigger mess the world would be if President Biden was a full-time president. That was the letter to the editor submitted by Therese Myers, who lives on Maple Road in Holy Cross, Iowa. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Thursday, January 11th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.